What's up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast, your morning starting pitching podcast brought to you by PitcherList.com. My name is Jake Crumpler, and today is August 15th. Let's break down every single start from August 14th. We'll start it off with Clay Holmes, and some pitchers are perfect fits for certain teams. The trade deadline creates some matches made in heaven. We get pitchers with untapped potential heading to analytically advanced franchises, homer-prone pitchers finding a new home in a pitcher-friendly ballpark, and ground ball pitchers joining a club with elite defense. The Cubs acquired one of baseball's premier worm killers when they traded for Clay Holmes at the deadline, putting the grounder-addicted Holmes in front of baseball's finest defense was an absolute no-brainer. Among qualified pitchers since 2021, Holmes has the second highest ground ball rate in baseball. And over the past 4 years, the Cubs defense has led MLB in outs above average while leading in defensive runs saved for the past 2 years combined. On Friday, we got a glimpse into the utopia that these soulmates conceived. The Adobe hosted the rival Cardinals, tossing 6 2/3 shutout innings, allowing just one hit and one walk while striking out three. He induced three whiffs with 31% CSW across 80 pitches to earn the win. As expected, it was a dirty baseball party as Holmes induced 67% ground balls while his teammates fulfilled their half of the bargain, scooping up everything to allow him to record 17 outs on 18 balls in play. Should we be thanking Koufax? Is this just the baseball gods giving fortunate luck to Holmes, or do the circumstances make this a sustainable approach? I'm surprisingly leaning toward the latter assertion. We've seen the Cubs get the most out of pitch to contact arms like Jameson Taillon, Javier Assad, Colin Ray, and most notably Kyle Hendricks over the past few years. Holmes arguably has better stuff than all of those guys, and he's already proven that he can excel for long stretches, even with a notably inferior Mets defense backing him up. That Mets defense was 12th in defensive runs saved and 21st in outs above average during Holmes' tenure, far away worse than the amazing Cubs defense. Don't expect a high ceiling from Holmes. He's not somebody who's going to rack up a boatload of strikeouts. He's fanned more than six just three times in his career, which spans 42 starts, and he's recorded a single-digit swinging strike rate across the past 2 years while he's been a starter. However, you can count on his heavy sinker to stay low in the zone to steal plenty of called strikes while inducing an outsized amount of ground balls for Alex Bregman, Dansby Swanson, Nico Horner, and Michael Bush to gobble up. Is it an oxymoron to call Holmes an elite Toby the rest of the day? I'd be downloading him onto deep league fantasy rosters and considering him one of the safest streaming options in standard leagues moving forward. Now let's see how every other starting pitcher did on Friday, starting with Chase Burns versus the Marlins. 7 shutout innings, 4 hits, no walks, and 8 strikeouts. Ace is going to ace for Chase Burns, and there go my concerns about his career-high workload leading to fatigue. Burns completed 7 frames for just the second time this year, displaying both stamina and efficiency, something that he's lacked in recent starts. The velocity is also back above 98 miles per hour, and the Blake Snell blueprint is being pulled off as well. We are all good, y'all. Next, we've got Brandon Pfaadt in Atlanta. 7 shutout innings, 2 hits, no walks, 7 strikeouts. And this Vargas role won't end until the Pfaadt lady sings. Pfaadt completed 7 shutout innings for the third time in his last 4 games. And the one start where he didn't do that, he tossed 6 2/3 innings with 1 unearned run. Just unreal results from a guy who's so reliant on the fortunate luck of Koufax, giving him the kind of high five that turns heads, the one that you just hear the loud smack and you turn around and you're like, what was that? Just a perfect high five. And that's what Pfaadt has been getting from Koufax recently. And I'm sure you're asking how you can say that this was just fortunate batted ball luck when he struck out a season high 7 batters with a season high 13 whiffs. And that's totally a fair point. It is a 1.15 ERA and a 0.88 whip since Pfaadt returned to the rotation. I think it's been 8 or 9 starts or something, but that's come with a 14% strikeout rate. The strikeout rate, the strike, The seven strikeouts here were the peak. This is the peak of Fott's powers, and he needs his best command and some good fortune in two strike counts to reach this peak. The approach, pristine changeups low and arm side, four seamers upstairs, curveballs falling below the zone and cutters, glove side with sweepers handling right-handed batters all by themselves is clearly working, and we just got to ride this hot streak as long as it lasts and then jump off as soon as it shows signs of it being shut down. I can't believe that his mix of this kitchen sink and sometimes the four-seamer changeup approach and sometimes the sinker-sweeper approach has had this much success. And it's not like he's facing easy offenses along the way either. He faced the Dodgers last time and got Hotlanta here. I can't believe this keeps working, but it's clearly he's got a good feel for his entire arsenal and he's avoiding the heart of the zone consistently. Next, we've got Robert Stock versus the Nationals. 4 1/3 scoreless innings, 3 hits, 3 walks, and 5 strikeouts. And I can totally see this surprise return to the majors working for one of my favorite social media users in Robert Stock. But with his velocity falling a couple of ticks from his impressive debut, it gets harder to believe in. And when I say I could see this working, I'm talking about the deepest of leagues. The improved stuff and flat arm angle are just conversation starters. We need to see Stock display a consistent ability to unleash his stuff correctly and efficiently to survive 5 frames often before we invest any roster spots in leagues 15 teams and shallower. Next, we have Kyle Freeland in San Francisco with 8 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. And dude, Kyle, you got to tell us ahead of time so we can plan our days around your birthday party. I understand if it snuck up on you. My birthday's sneaking up on me too. I got to figure out what I'm going to do for it. If you got any suggestions for me, reach out to me on Twitter or send me a DM on Discord, etc. Reach out to me. I need some ideas for my birthday. Regardless, talking about Kyle Freeland, there's something different about Freeland this August. He hasn't allowed more than 1 run in 3 outings, the first of which lasted 9 frames. The second came with a hook in the 5th inning, but he had 8 more innings of 1 run ball here on Friday. And late season success has been a constant throughout Freeland's career. His splits exhibit a clear negative correlation between his ERA and the later months, meaning as the season wears on, he pitches better and better. It's a 5.16 ERA in April, but a 5.72 mark in May. And then from there, it just goes down. 4.75 ERA in June, 4.39 ERA in July, and a 4.27 ERA in August, culminating in his best months of the year, September / October, which have come with a 4.07 ERA throughout his career. And imagine if he got a pitch in the postseason. Oh, he has, and you're not going to believe it. 6 2/3 shutout innings back in 2018, his only playoff start. Yeah, there's absolutely no way. I cannot believe that this is actually a thing for Freeland. He's clearly a guy who likes to get into a rhythm, and he's in one right now. But is it enough to help us forget that he's allowed the second most runs in MLB this year, trailing only Michael Lorenzen, his teammate? Definitely not when he hosts the Dodgers in Coors next. Next, we've got Sandy Alcantara in Cincinnati. 7 innings, 1 earned, 3 hits, 4 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And Alcantara's scoreless streak concluded at 25 2/3 frames, and he nearly made it a 4th straight scoreless start, but a 2-out double in the 6th spat on his shutout. Like a toddler eating spaghetti, it was very messy. Twice as many walks as strikeouts, 3 of which came in full counts as Sandy struggled to put batters away with a 12% put-away rate, which is super unlucky. He should have had much more success in 2 strike counts and had more strikeouts in this one. And I'll blame it his inability to get batters to chase his changeup out of the zone and his unwillingness to throw sliders in 2 strike counts on that low put away rate. And I implore you to keep starting the man who has a sub 2.5 ERA since the start of June and a sub 2 ERA since the beginning of July. Next, we have Yoshinobu Yamamoto versus the Brewers. 6 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, and 9 strikeouts. And ace is going to ace for a King Cole as Yamamoto led baseball with 37% CSW on Friday. And I've been saying that Yamamoto sort of forgot how to strike batters out, and maybe I didn't use those words exactly, but yeah, that was definitely something I've been saying. And this doesn't really change how I feel about Yamamoto. I've never doubted his ability. I just recognize that he's not a near 30% strikeout rate arm like he was last year. Not that there's anything wrong with that. We love his pristine ratios and his increased win opportunities. And we got to thank Yoshi for being one of the just most reliable pitchers in baseball, just an absolute stud all year. Next, we have Shane Bieber versus the Yankees. 6 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, and 5 strikeouts. And I find it so hard to make a decision on pitchers like this. They get me all excited. Then they go and betray me as soon as I'm ready to put my faith in them. And then that makes me think that my faith in them was unwarranted. And then that's only for them to bounce back and dominate as they've got like a little wry smile and a wink as it feels like they know what they're doing to me. They're just stressing me out so much. And maybe that's just a lack of confidence in my initial assessment that allows the results on the field to cloud my judgment. Maybe it's just the fluctuations of luck in this chaotic sport we call baseball. Maybe it's just the randomness of small sample sizes that make pitcher analysis cloudy, regardless of how established an arm is. I want to believe in Bieber's resurgence, but sub 60% overall strikes indicates a lack of command that manifested in center cut four seamers, curveballs eating a lot of dirt, and chaotic changeups. Bieber somehow walked just one batter and served up only a solo shot in this one, despite the lack of command and swing and miss in this one, as he had just 5 whiffs. And I cannot trust him in Tampa Bay next. So, of course, watch him go out there and get it done again. Next, we have Gerrit Cole in Toronto. 6 innings, 1 earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, and 5 strikeouts. And ace is going to ace. Cole is avoiding the heart of the zone, but it's not coming with the elite precision that leads me to proclaim his return to premier acedom. He's still dope, but until sliders land low and glove side with four seamers thriving upstairs, I'll continue to view him as a diminished version of his former self. He's still an ace, but not the otherworldly talent that puts him in the conversation for the best starter in baseball. Next, we have Chris Sale versus Arizona, if we're talking about the conversation for best starter in baseball. 6 innings, 1 earned, 5 hits, 9 walks, and 9 strikeouts from Sale. Ace is going to ace. And I mean, what did you expect? He's dominated all year and it's not stopping anytime soon. And this could have been historic if not for a ridiculous 31% foul ball rate. That was 33 total foul balls against Sale that prevented him from inducing even more whiffs, racking up even more strikeouts, and pitching even deeper into the game. He had 11 whiffs and 108 pitches through 6 innings here. But regardless, Sale is dope and he makes us feel dope for rostering him. Next, we have Andrew Alvarez in New York against the Mets. 5 2/3 innings, 2 earned, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 4 strikeouts. And I feel like one of my grandma's friends when I say, "Who is this man? I barely recognize you," all grown up after he's completed 5 frames just once in his first 15 outings. Alvarez has done so in each of his last 3 starts since returning from the minors at the beginning of August. It's not a result of a higher pitch count, though, as he's averaged just 76 pitches in that trio of starts. He's just been more efficient, which is sort of just another way of saying that he's been luckier. Yep, you can thank Koufax for the 40 outs he's returned on 48 balls in play in August alone. His breakers are cool, but the heaters aren't, and there's no way this is lasting much longer for Andrew Alvarez. Next, we have Matthew Liberatore in Chicago against the Cubs. 5 1/3 innings, 2 earned, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 6 strikeouts as he earned the gallows pull by leading baseball with 16 whiffs. A gallows pull from Matthew Liberatore. This is the first time the Southpaw has won any sort of pitcherless award, and he did something he should have done a long time ago: cut back on fastballs. He took 11% off his four-seamer usage, 6% off his sinker usage, and 2% off his cutter usage to feature more breakers. Curveballs were thrown 11% more often, up to 27% usage, and they induced 6 whiffs and 35% CSW. And sliders were not only thrown 11% more often as well, up to 35% usage, but they also gained 3 to 4 inches of drop, allowing them to dominate to the tune of 7 whiffs, 42% CSW, and 72% strikes. Hooks and slow balls combined for just 39% strikes, but that's why you don't stop throwing the fastballs altogether. Something's got to stick around to prop up the strikeout, just prop up the strike rate and keep batters honest. This is honestly the most confident I've ever been in Liberatore, but it'll take at least one more outing with his new approach returning excellent results for me to ignore the awful ratios he has on the season. He's got an ERA over 5 and a WHIP nearing 1.5. Liberatore's next start will be in Cincinnati, and that's one I'm going to be keeping an eye on. Next, we'll talk about Chris Bassitt, Bubba Chandler, Peter Lambert, and the rest of the pitchers from Friday's games. But first, we're going to take a quick break here on the Plus Pitch Podcast. And we're back. Jake Crumpler here, breaking down every single starter from Friday's games, resuming with Chris Bassitt in Tampa Bay, 5 1/3 innings, 2 earned, 5 hits, 3 walks, and 3 strikeouts. And having spent the last 2 months on the IL, 2+ months really, following surgery to remove bone spurs from his back. It sounds pretty painful. Bassitt was rightfully rusty, and considering the circumstances, this wasn't half bad, but it's the same kitchen sink approach that we're used to, the same one that made Bassitt a Toby that was not worth rostering when he was healthy. But it is cool seeing his curveball get even more break in this one, and that's a really big slow pitch and one that he's probably going to have a hard time controlling moving forward. He's not somebody that I want to trust in the majority of fantasy leagues. Next, we have Bubba Chandler versus the Red Sox. 5 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, and 5 strikeouts, though it came with just 5 whiffs. And it's really funny trying to put into words what makes pitchers like Chandler and the aforementioned Shane Bieber only to remember what makes these pitchers tick. It's only to remember that Nick has done this for years and has a whole database of terms describing exactly what takes me an entire blurb to explain. Chandler's volatile, unpredictable, and generally unrosterable performances are the qualities of a hipster, a headache-inducing pitcher that stifles the entire roster, which is probably the label I'd put on Shane Bieber too. These are guys where it's so hard to figure out what they're doing each night out, and you never know if the approach or the results are going to stay. Chandler finds something that works, but once it becomes popular, for example, people get excited about it, he switches things up or he watches his success wane, forcing him to try something new. And I'm all for doing unique things that make you feel like a special and individual person. I'm famous for not watching shows because everybody watches it, or being proud of myself because I, for example, listen to music that maybe other people don't listen to. And that's something I'm always trying to work on. I don't want to be somebody who's being a hipster for the sake of being a hipster, but that's sort of what Chandler does. I don't think he's doing that on purpose, but he has the stuff to succeed. He just needs to figure out an approach that works. I like the changes he's made to his slider. I like how great his fastball is. It just hasn't worked for more than 3 starts in a row all year. And with just 5 whiffs here, I'm not ready to trust Chandler moving forward. Next, we have Peter Lambert versus the Mariners. 5 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. And unlike Adam Lambert's final American Idol performance, a change is not going to come to Peter's labels. The guy is a Holly through and through, and it's a glorious thing. Lambert digs into his bag of tricks to pull out a trio of pitches every start that can just get the job done. It was the 4-seamer at 38% CSW, the changeup with 4 whiffs, and the sinker with 77% strikes on Friday. Next time, it may be this sweeper joining the fray, or the cutter, or the curveball, or I think you get the point. Next, we have Jesse Schultens versus the Orioles. 3 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And we're back to Schultens pitching as a bulk reliever. Please hold your applause until the end of the blurb. Steven Matz opened with a scoreless frame, and Schultens took it from there, turning to splitters as his primary offering while showcasing a new slider that is definitely now a cutter at nearly 90 miles per hour with 10 inches of IVB and negative 3 inches of induced horizontal break, or negative 3 inches meaning 3 inches horizontally beyond the middle of the pitch movement profile plot. And if you're looking to vulture a win at some point over the next few weeks, I think Schultens is your guy. The improvements are definitely clear in the slider turn cutter, and the Rays definitely set him up for success. If he's pitching in bulk relief, then he's got a pretty good shot at getting a win. Just don't expect great ratios or a lot of strikeouts. Next, we have Robert Gasser in LA against the Dodgers. 6 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 8 hits, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. And you throw those cutters, Bobby. They were the star of the show with plus 17% usage to 34%, overshadowing the success of changeups. And we've been waiting for that slow ball to thrive forever. It induced 7 whiffs and 50% CSW, finally giving Gasser a reliable put-away pitch versus right-handed batters. He's got that sweeper versus lefties, and with the cutter, a pitch that can work versus both-handedness and a fastball, 4-seamer that can stay upstairs. he sort of got all the weapons. And if not for solo shots in the fifth and sixth inning, I think we'd be singing Gasser's praises for starring in Hollywood. This is the step in the right direction we needed to consider streaming him versus Hotlanta next. I'll have Gasser in the questionable start tier, but he's moving up my ranks pretty quickly. Next, we have Michael King in Cleveland. Six innings, three earned, eight hits, one walk, and four strikeouts. The King hath not returned, but his command hath. King's four main offerings each eclipsed 66% strikes, and they landed in their respective quadrants against a left-handed batter, only Guardians lineup. The pristine command was around last time too, but even at his best, this was merely a very poor quality start from King, as he had nine base runners and induced just four whiffs. He may need to live out of the zone more than he did here to induce the whiffs that he was so desperately lacking on Friday. But regardless, I think the command has me confident enough to flip the coin on this cherry bomb in New York against the Mets next. Next, we've got Gage Jump versus the Rangers. Five and a third innings, three earned, three hits, four walks, and just one strikeout. Maybe we shouldn't have used all of our strikeouts in our last start when Gage Jump racked up 11 strikeouts. Now he leaves us here with dry bread. How am I supposed to butter my bread with just one strikeout? This is going to be a difficult blurb to write without a complete alphabet, as we used up all our K's last time, but watch me do it. Jump was surviving with some help from the baseball gods before it all fell apart in the sixth, culminating in a three-run home run. Careful Icarus on that one, as he was pushed a little bit too far. He's way too unpredictable at the moment. He's not guaranteed to blow up in Sacramento, but he's also not a sure thing to succeed on the road. He's not guaranteed to fan enough batters to maintain our happiness and the butter on our bread, but he's also capable of coaxing smiles by eclipsing double-digit punchouts. Jump screams hipster and cherry bomb to me, despite the clear upside that he's shown throughout the season. Look, Ma, no K's. Next, we have Kumar Rocker in Sacramento. Five innings, three earned, four hits, five walks, and three strikeouts. And the Rocker star jammed out with his slide guitar, but he couldn't find the right backing track to make it all come together. Seven whiffs on sliders with pristine locations low and glove side. Everything else, though, zero whiffs and sub 50% strikes. This wasn't just a product of Sacre Verde pitching in Sacramento, as Rocker actually didn't give up a single homer there. This was just poor command and poor stuff, to be honest. Just no support for his slider, and there's a lot of work to do, and I'm already working overtime, so this is the guy that I'm going to give a break, especially with the Nationals on the horizon. Next, we have Grayson Rodriguez versus the Royals. Four innings, three earned, three hits, two walks, and five strikeouts. And there was some intrigue that Grayrod might be figuring it out when his breakers actually showed up to support his fastball changeup combo last time, but they went back into hiding on Friday. Sliders and curveballs were thrown less than a quarter of the time, despite recording 43% CSW combined, as he doesn't trust them against left-handed batters. The command wasn't there at 52% strikes on the breakers, so I sort of don't blame him, but let them do a bit more so your fastball can play up and act as the strike pitch rather than the whiff pitch it struggled to be this year due to its empty velocity. He's got great extension. He throws 96 miles per hour, so there's definitely some potential in that fastball, but the IVB is just like slightly below what you want. It's not the flattest attack angle either. And I see a path to success for Grayrod featuring secondaries more than heaters. If he cuts back on the fastball, I think he's throwing it over 50% of the time. If that goes down to maybe a third of the time or a quarter of the time, and he just focuses on those changeup sliders and curveballs, I actually believe this could work, but I don't trust the Angels to get the most out of an already frustrating pitcher. Next, we have Jose Urquidy in Detroit. Three and two-thirds innings, three earned, five hits, no walks, and three strikeouts. And after a five-month stint in the minors, actually, I think it was 4 months, he last pitched in April, Urquidy is back pitching in bulk relief of opener Sean Newcomb. There was once a time when Urquidy was a breakout candidate when he was on the Astros. And with a decently shaped four-seamer displaying increased velocity combined with an effective changeup, I see what got people interested in the first place. If breakers can become more consistent to return more than the 53% strikes they earned on Friday, I could see Urquidy being a risky win play as a bulk reliever. But for now, we avoid and honestly hope that the White Sox give one of their plethora of young starters a chance in the rotation instead of relying on Urquidy. Next, we've got Landon Roop versus the Rockies, 5 2/3 innings, 4 earned, 5 hits, 3 walks, and 5 strikeouts. Even Rocky Road wasn't enough to cure Roop's walk issues. That's a 14% walk rate and just an 18% strikeout rate across his last 8 starts after running a 9% mark and a 26% strikeout rate through his first 16 starts. With excellent pitch separation and an avoidance of the heart of the zone, I'm curious why his overall command has been so much worse. Is it just a lack of focus in 3-ball counts, or is he just living out of the zone too much and not getting the chases that he deserves? I'm honestly just going to remain adamant that Roop is a tweak away from returning to domination, because that pitch separation is hard to find on pitchers. If you've been watching this on YouTube, you'll see how often pitches are clumped together or like all over the place. But you see with Roop, he does such a good job of pulling off the Blake Snell blueprint and typically splitting changeups and curveballs, arm side and glove side. But it may be best to give him a break in Cleveland next, because he just has not been able to nail down his control. Next, we've got Jake Bennett in Pittsburgh. 4 innings, 4 earned, 5 hits, 1 walk, and 6 strikeouts. And come on, Jake, you're tarnishing my name. The Pirates aren't even good against southpaws. There is a very promising silver lining to this terrible line, though, as Bennett's command has returned. We were just talking about the Blake Snell blueprint and pitch separation with Landon Roop, and we saw even better from Jake Bennett. Elite pitch separation as he pulled off the Blake Snell blueprint with 4-seamers upstairs and changeups down low, about as best as you could hope for. It had been missing. His command had been missing recently, leading to a stark downturn in performance, but having added a tick of velocity as well with the return of his command, my faith in streaming Bennett has returned. Let's take the chance that the command sticks, allowing him to take down the Diamondbacks next. Next, we've got Seth Lugo in LA against the Angels. 4 2/3 innings, 5 earned, 7 hits, no walks, and 4 strikeouts. And I've heard people, and I've called him myself a surgeon, but this is a botched surgery from Lugo, and I think he needs to take a break to focus on his precision. It's just not all there. He's got a little extra velocity on the curveball, but it's just not at the level that it used to be. And the kitchen sink approach needs to be perfect. It needs to be commanded just absolutely pristinely for Lugo to succeed. And that hasn't been the case most of the year. From time to time, he has been all right. He's definitely somebody that is worth rostering in quality start leagues, but elsewhere, he's somebody that you probably want to avoid, because he's not going to have a strikeout ceiling worth chasing, and the ratio floor is pretty low. Next, we have George Kirby in Houston. 4 2/3 innings, 5 earned, 8 hits, 3 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And Kirby is just unable to maximize the potential of his arsenal. Sweepers failed to coax chases or find the zone, leading to 55% strikes. Great, let's throw them as our primary pitch. No, I don't know what he's thinking. Sinkers failed to miss bats and avoid damage. Dope. Let's make that our number two offering. I don't know what he's doing. 4-seamers get a pass, but curveballs, they were actually dope too, with 44% CSW falling below the zone for a trio of whiffs and buying up free real estate in the zone for 4 called strikes. Maybe the curveballs are only successful as a surprise pitch, but maybe try throwing your best pitch on a night more often than 16% of the time. And I sort of wish that Kirby got traded instead of Castillo. Yeah, he'd lose the great ballpark that he calls home, but maybe another club would have been able to help him find an approach that performs up to its potential, up to his potential. Second to last, we've got Gavin Williams versus the Padres. 4 1/3 innings, 5 earned, 7 hits, 4 walks, and 5 strikeouts. And Ace is going to make us reconsider his Ace is going to Ace tag. Williams deserved it after fanning 10-plus batters for 5 straight starts. But the last two haven't been nearly as good. He didn't command 4-seamers well on Friday, forcing him to throw breakers nearly 2/3 of the time. But with the schedule looking oh so cushy with the Giants, Anaheim, and then the Blue Jays on the horizon, I think we can write this one off as a one-night bland and just say, what are you going to do? Sometimes he just doesn't have it. And I think he's going to bounce back right away. I have a lot of faith in Gavin Williams. Lastly, we've got Jackson Job versus the White Sox. 3 2/3 innings, 6 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, and 4 strikeouts. And oof, I sang Job's praises after he exhibited increased velocity and an elite slider in his season debut. And there was a slight decrease in his velocity here, but it's still up 1 to 2 ticks from its pre-surgery baseline to sit around 98 miles per hour. And I think the biggest thing that I might have missed is that this might be more empty velocity than I initially determined, because the fastball doesn't have exceptional shape. And because he has below average extension, he needs that velocity near 98 and not 96, 97 like it was last year for him to blow it by batters. He's got a lower arm angle this year, which allows him to get a steeper approach to the plate, but I don't know if that's going to be enough to prevent his fastball from being as hittable as it was on Friday, as it served up five hits and a pair of long balls. His command of sliders away also disappeared, and I should say glove side, not away, as they either missed way out of the zone or landed middle, leading to just 50% strikes. I was happy to see changeup step up a little for Jobe, with four whiffs and 50% CSW, giving me some hope that he has the weapons to support his 1-2 punch when they aren't at his best. But I also want to write this one off as maybe a loss of focus on those two home runs, as he just put a pair of fastballs right down the middle, which you can't be doing against a major league team. And he sort of got singled out with a 500 BABIP, but it's really difficult to ignore how much more this start aligns with his 2025 performance than his dope debut did. He's a guy with what seems like great stuff, but he did not parlay that into success in his first semi-full season last year. Maybe this is more of a 2027 play. And heading to Pittsburgh next, I think we have to bench him because of how good that lineup has been. And then we'll reassess afterward. I still see the potential in Jackson Jobe. It just was not coming together in this one. All right, now we can look forward to Saturday, my matchup of the day, game of the day, Jacob Mizorowski versus Justin Wroblewski. Looking for Wroblewski to bounce back. It's been really tough sailing recently, but this is mostly about watching Mizorowski continue his historic season in a playoff preview against the two-time reigning champion Dodgers. But that'll do it for today's episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. You can find the article that accompanies this podcast, the SP Roundup, over at pitcherless.com, where you can find a lot more of my work as well. I do the First Pitch Podcast 4 days a week. There I also do the Bullpen Podcast, the In the Pen Podcast, and you can find more of my work over at baseballhq.com, where I do playing time analysis for the Giants, A's, Angels, and Diamondbacks. But you can follow me on Twitter at Jake Crumpler to find even more of my work, where I do daily SP streamers and I break down every single start via the pitcher list stats, player cards. But you can find links to all of my work at crumplerbaseball.com. That'll do it. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.